Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 268. Abraham did kill Isaac. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And as we get towards the conclusion of this series of episodes that we've been doing on the Bible, although like many of our subjects, it's one that we'll come back to, we're excited today to be talking to the author of a new book that serves as a great introduction to the way that the Bible is studied in the modern academy, but it's so accessible and it's so fun to read. There are some classics in this field that are wonderful books. My favorite is Who Wrote the Bible by Richard Elliot Friedman. It was a book that I read when I was 17 years old and it really changed my life. There are also some really wonderful books that people can read, particularly about how archaeology fits into the picture, like The Bible Unearthed, and David and Solomon, which are both by Israel Finkelstein and Neil Asher Silberman. If anybody's really interested in finding a way into this, send me an email because it's really something that I particularly enjoy talking to people about and helping people find their way into. By the way, reading some of this material on critical Bible study has been something that's been discussed by previous guests on Judaism Unbound. You would think that people who read about critical Bible study, the idea that the Bible was written by numerous authors as opposed to God or Moses, that would somehow be damaging to people's faith. And maybe for some people it is, but for other people whose faith has already been shaken in some of those ideas, the opportunity to connect to the Bible in a different way and to understand the Bible still as a really important and powerful work, and having never been introduced really to how this book might have come about in a different way other than the traditional way that it's been taught, can be very liberating for people and very exciting and very inviting back into Judaism. And that's something that we hope that maybe this series has done a little bit for some of our listeners. And some of these books are really amazing opportunities to dive deeper into them. Our guest today, Tzemach Yoreh, is the author of a new book called Why Abraham Murdered Isaac, The First Stories of the Bible Revealed. And unlike some of the other books, which are more organized chronologically, this one is organized almost like an archaeological dig, where we're really trying to understand what was that base first layer of the Bible, and then how and why was it added onto. And we look at that story by story by story, and it's just a new way to present this material in a way that we found particularly engaging and exciting. Why Abraham Murdered Isaac will be available as an ebook starting this coming Tuesday, April 8th. You can get it wherever you get ebooks. And it's not Tzemach Yoreh's first book on the Bible. In fact, he's written many of them. You can find them all listed at a site called Modern Scriptures. It actually has a different website. It's www.biblecriticism.com, where you can see a wide variety of his books, which include not only books about the Bible, he has also written a series of books on humanist prayer. Because in addition to having two PhDs in Bible criticism and ancient wisdom literature, Tzemach Yoreh is also a humanist rabbi. He has a rabbinical ordination from the Israeli affiliate of the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism. We've had a number of guests related to the humanistic Jewish movement on the podcast over the years. And he is now the rabbi of the City Congregation of New York, which is the humanistic congregation in New York City. Tzemach Yoreh, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you very much.
In this book, you talk a lot about what you call the, quote, original Bible. Could you tell us a little bit about what that original Bible is, what you mean by it, when it was written? What is this original Bible that you're finding within the Bible as we know it?
What I mean by that is that this is the first story chronologically that was written down. And then every subsequent story was built upon it. So that's what I mean by the original Bible, probably more accurately, the original Torah.
Tell us a little more about what that means to sort of open up a version of the Bible that we have, which is to say, I don't know, the unoriginal or like another version.
Yeah.
What is that like archaeology task like where you're sort of, I use archaeology because it seems like digging. It's like you're looking through layers.
Yeah.
And the second question, who cares? there, you had a great sentence or two in your book where you're like, so one person wrote the Bible or 25 people wrote the Bible. Like, so what? We have a thing now. Like, what is it? What are the ramifications if multiple people wrote this or if there was an original source or not?
I like the comparison to archaeology. You know, it's just a productive one, because the way I look at the Torah especially is that it's a like sediment that accrues. I think of layers as opposed to sources, as opposed to documents. And there's one basic story, and then every subsequent author added their own layer to it until it arrived at the text that we have. And so I can choose a chapter.
Choose.
Okay. Let me just start where I start the book. I mean, why Abraham murdered Isaac, the story of Abraham. So let's start with chapter 20, verse 1. So Abraham traveled toward the land of the south and lived between Kadesh and Shur. He lived as a foreigner in Gerar. So you can ask, like, why did I start here? Well, it's because it's the first time I identify a particular writer who I think is the first writer. And I identify him here for a variety of reasons that actually many other Bible scholars agree with, meaning it's here first where you see Elohim rather than other names for God. Elohim is used beforehand, but it is used by a different author, an author who is very, I like to call him the accountant, very organized, very, you know, you see him in Genesis 1. So he's a very different kind of author. So this is the first time I see a story that uses the name Elohim, but it's really just a story, not like a list, not an accountant. So Abraham traveled toward the land of the south and lived between Kadesh and Shur. He lived as a foreigner in Gerar. Abraham said about Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." Avimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. This is a story, there are actually three of them, where one of the patriarchs, Abraham and two of them, and Isaac and another, present their wives as their sisters. And then the monarch, in two of the stories, takes their sister or wife. And in another story, almost does. And so what is the relationship between those three stories? Those three stories should have a relationship. And so which story comes first? The story in Genesis 12, which is the first iteration of the story, or the story in Genesis 20? And so for a lot of reasons, I think it's the story in Genesis 20 that came first. And over here, this is hard to really see in the English, but Avimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. The verb to take in biblical Hebrew, when a man takes a woman, has a sexual connotation to it. It means that he has sexual relations with the woman. So this is, of course, very problematic, because Sarah is a matriarch, and in chapter 21, she gives birth to Isaac. So what she does at this point is very critical. We want to know who Isaac is, like where he comes from. And if Sarah is having sexual relations with someone else, then Abraham may not be the father. So, you know, this bears a relationship to chapter 12 in the book of Genesis, where Pharaoh takes Sarah into his house. And again, in chapter 12, sexual relations is implied. And in fact, highly suggested. Rashi, who is a medieval commentator, says that Pharaoh was sick with couldn't perform. You know, it's a difficult situation. It's a very critical issue, and it's not just a critical issue for me. It was a critical issue for much earlier rabbis. Of course, it's critical in the context of the biblical text as well.
Well, and one thing that, if I understand this correctly, the original author that you're going to be talking about comes from the north of the land of Israel, which in the biblical times, there were two kingdoms, a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. And one of the scandalous things that would be for us today scandalous with the idea that maybe Isaac was not the son of Abraham is that that would mean that we're not descended from Abraham, right? But in the north, they didn't think they were descended from Abraham, so it was no big deal, right? This is just a story about Abraham, and he had this son who turned out to be the son of this foreign king, and then later, as you're going to get to, he killed him. So, okay, nice story. It doesn't matter because he's not our ancestor, right?
To an extent, that's right. Meaning, in the North, it seems like the myth that at least this original story is telling is that Jacob was the ancestor, and Jacob was not the son of Isaac. And so, where does Jacob come from? Well, you know, the answer I give is fairly glib. I say he comes from Beersheba,
which is a place.
Yeah. And, you know, that, you know, it's not telling his prehistory, but that's because a story has to start somewhere. For the Northern Kingdom, the story started with Jacob. And verse 3, God came to Avimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." That seems fairly straightforward. Okay. He had sexual relations with Sarah, adultery, albeit. You know, he did not mean to do that, but nonetheless, he deserves to die. Seems fairly unjust. You know, he didn't know what he was doing, but the sense of what is just and what is not just, it's a story. We don't have to be completely tied to those notions. We can just hold them in reserve for questions later. So again, you see the verb taken, you know, taken sexually. Or otherwise, if he had just taken her and not done anything to her, why would he be liable to be killed? Like he should be okay. If he hadn't done anything, he should be okay. For all that implication that they had sexual relations, verse 4 immediately goes ahead and says, now Avimelech had not come near her. Okay, that's news to us, you know, considering what it was implied. But here you have a contradiction, meaning there's one version that's the first verses are implying that they had sexual relations. And now immediately it says they did not have sexual relations. So here we have a contradiction and we have to resolve it. And one of the ways we resolve it is by assuming more than one author. So here's the beginning of that happening in this chapter. And so here we have an interesting dream dialogue in verses 4 to 6. Avimelech had not come nearer. He said, "Lord, will you kill even a righteous nation? Didn't he tell me she is my sister? She herself said he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, have I done this?" Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this. And I have also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not allow you to touch her." See, again, emphasized again and again, they did not have sexual relations. 3 times in the course of that.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Yeah, I did not have sex with that woman. Yes. But there's another very interesting aspect to these verses, and that is that this is a dialogue in a dream. Now, if you look at dreams in the Tanakh, in the whole of the Hebrew Bible, people weren't having dialogues in dreams. That's not something, there's only one other occurrence of that, and that's a dialogue that God has with Solomon, in which there's a very, very long passage which God is delivering, so really not comparable. But the text is cognizant that it's at odds. It says, God said to him in the dream. It has to remind you that we're in a dream. So since we may have lost track of that fact. For those reasons, I assume that verses 4 to 6 were added to this chapter. And I assume that, we have here a contradiction. We have here divergent details. And we have here something that just doesn't occur elsewhere in biblical narrative. So a singular occurrence. And so for those reasons, I would say the verses 4 to 6 were actually added by somebody who was very concerned that Sarah not have sexual relations with Avimelech, which is something very, very understandable because the next chapter has Isaac being born. And we want to be sure that Isaac's parentage is through Abraham.
So that brings us to the who cares. I'm excited. So like I get the point you're making, and I think that it's very, very persuasive. I am now a total adherent of verses 4 to 6, a very specific Jewish movement of those who will now espouse that verses 4 to 6 of chapter 20 of Genesis are a new source. You have recruited me. Now, what should I be telling people the ramifications of that are? Who cares?
Well, I think that there's a very important meta point to make about this. There's never been one story. Stories shift and change, and we retell them to fit our cultural generational circumstances. And it's a point that you find right in the Hebrew Bible itself, if you look closely enough. And then, you know, it loosens like this idea, this is the truth. You know, my reading of the Bible is the one that we should, you know, accept. I look at it through a supplementary, a accretional paradigm that stories built upon each other, but there are just multiple stories out there in the Hebrew Bible, multiple perspectives. And so nobody has a monopoly over the story.
Why, for example, would this person who corrected the story to make sure that they emphasized that they never actually had sex, first of all, why do they preserve the story at all? Why do they leave this part of the story where it says he took her? You know, why not just kind of erase that line and only have the part where they don't have sex? Like, how do you understand the way that this work happened?
I think there was erasure wasn't part of the bargain. What that means is that it's accretional. People just built on each other. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward. It's because the text was regarded as important. You don't excise this editorial process that we're very used to in the modern world where we can X out and reorganize. And I don't think that was really a part of what was happening a lot in the ancient world, maybe to some extent, maybe when you really disagreed or whatever. But if it's a story that you're bringing down, it's you're preserving and handing it down to the next generation, it's a story you respect. So you're not going to tamper with it in that way. You will add to it. You'll add on the margins. You'll add at the beginning, at the end, but you won't actually erase. And that's, I would say that's fundamental key to the way I understand how the Torah and other Hebrew Bible texts developed.
Follow up on that. I mean, I agree with you in many ways. I also want to play devil's advocate because, like, by definition, if something was in the original Bible and erased, then we don't have it. So, like, we can't point to it and say, ah, yes, a strategy that people used is they sometimes erased stuff, because if they erased it, they erased it.
Absolutely.
And so that's not to say I think for sure that happened. I do think that what you're saying about how something can have, like, cultural cachet so that you can't really erase it at a certain point, I think that's true.
Yeah.
And I think that there's some complications there. And so I guess this brings me to a related question, which is, maybe I wouldn't argue that there's people erasing, right? But for those who would say, okay, Tzemach, I'm with you, but, like, I'm not so sure about this original Bible. I can agree with you that there are different sources happening in this text of Genesis 20, but I'm not sure that one of them is, say, the original, so mm-hmm. much as it's part of a source, which people, you know, they have names for these sources, J and E and P and D, all mm-hmm. that stuff. Like, they would say, ah, yes, this points to there being multiple sources that are sort of in conversation with each other, and that there's, like, a redactor putting together at some stage, etc. But they would argue it doesn't necessarily point to an original Bible from which the others flowed. So I don't really know where I'm situated in that debate, but I'm curious how you would articulate your case that no, this specifically does point to an original Bible and yeah. not to multiple different traditions in different places or times that were put together.
So you're absolutely right that's a weak point in any argument. The argument from the silence is hard to make. What if something is erased? I will never know that it was erased. Like, and we won't know. When you make that kind of argument, the way you have to proceed is through aggregate. If you find coherence at each level, if you find a story that's being told, a story that is coherent at each stage, it seems more likely. I think that it's more likely that the dynamic of erasure was limited. The test of a model in any scientific endeavor is how much it explains, how much new insight you can gain into it. And so I submit that my paradigm might be wrong, and I'm fully willing to admit that, but I'll also argue that it provides a lot of interesting new insights about how the texts work. And that's why I think it has that validity to it, meaning this is just a particular example about the murder of Isaac. But let's go to Genesis 22. So we're at the murder scene. While you may ask, there wasn't a murder in Genesis 22. Right before Abraham brings down his knife, the angel of God calls out from heaven and says, "Do not murder him." And then Isaac is replaced by a ram. That's how the story is told. But there is plenty of evidence that somebody was trying to cover up the scene of the crime. the most suggestive verse without any biblical criticism at all is verse 19 in Genesis 22. And that is, so Abraham returned to his young men and they rose up and went together to Beersheba. What's the problem here? Isaac's not there. Something happened to him. Okay, you could say that that's an omission. Okay, yeah, Abraham, the story's about Abraham. It's not about Isaac. So he went. But that's really an inadequate answer, considering that in previous verses, they emphasize that they went together twice in verse 6 and verse 8. And so this was actually very suggestive to post-biblical midrashim, which are elaborations of the story of the biblical text, that Isaac was actually sacrificed. And there's a whole book about it by Shalom Spiegel called The Last Trial. And he talks about this tradition of where Isaac was sacrificed. So this idea was present in the minds of early rabbis interpreting the text. And in liturgy, in prayers, you have references to the ashes of Isaac. Why do you have references to the ashes of Isaac? There was no burning. The ram was burnt. So again, it was very, people allude to the murder and then say, oh, the murder didn't happen. First of all, we have the motive. The motive, I think, is Abraham. This is not Abraham's son. So that's a flashback to Genesis 20. It seems like that Isaac may have been Avimelech's son. The early rabbis interpreting the text were worried about that possibility and had Isaac looking exactly like Abraham, because, what would people say if Isaac didn't look like Abraham? So they addressed that possibility very early on, that Isaac was Abraham's son and not someone else's son, not Avimelech's son. But there also has to be God's motive. Like, why does God ask Abraham to do it? Why do, the classic thing, God is testing Abraham. But that's kind of a cop-out, I would say, God, so why does God test Abraham? Why is Abraham? Why did Abraham warrant this kind of horrible test that where he commanded Abraham to sacrifice a child? Again, we have to go back to Genesis 20, and we see that Abraham simply did not trust in God. Trust in God is very important to this first author, to this first version of the Torah. And Abraham didn't trust in God because he presented his wife as his sister. He didn't trust that God would protect him. And so he created this horrible scene where Avimelech took Sarah into his house. And trusting in God is the most important thing for this particular storyline. And now, since Abraham did not trust in God in Genesis 20, God demands of him a much higher level of trust, of obedience. And that's why God commands Abraham sacrifice the son.
I'm curious about understanding this original Bible a little more. First of all, I just want to reassure the readers that if they read your book, they will find that there's additional linguistic and evidence that you find in the story of the sacrifice of Isaac that it really happened, that the murder really happened. So just to note on that yes. particular story, we can really sort of play it all out. But can you talk to us a little bit more about what are some of that author of the original Bible, what are some of the other worldviews that are maybe different from the Torah as we know it, and maybe some of the other elements that fall into the story? Like, for example, when I was a kid, and I've talked about this, that I read Richard Elliot Friedman's book, Who Wrote the Bible, when it came out in 1987, and that was life-changing for me. And the most exciting thing for me, I remember to this day, was the discovery that Moses and Aaron weren't really brothers, that Moses was the leader of the north and the lineage of the northern priests, and Aaron was the lineage of the southern priests, and they only became brothers much later when the north and south merged together and they had to create a story to put them together. Other people could hear that and say, oh, so the whole thing is BS. I heard and I was like, oh, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard. So could you talk some about, so I know Moses is a very important character in the North. Can you talk a little bit about who the Moses of the North is compared to the Moses of the South and other things that you think are important?
Yeah. So I think it's, as opposed to pretty much every other story in the Torah, the original Bible is a human-centered story God appears in the story less, is less of a character in the story. And it's manifest particularly with Moses, who is really the hero of the story. He does the plagues by himself. He takes the Israelites out of Egypt himself. He brings the Israelites into the land himself. All of this by himself with very minimal help from God. And he's presented as a magician. If you look at the Bible as it is, that is not the way Moses is presented. Moses is presented as a stutterer and somebody who is not an effective leader. And that the reason for that is to elevate God in the story of the, that's the primary reason, to elevate God in the story of the Exodus, to make God the hero of it. And we can find it most in the Passover Haggadah, where when we retell the story in the traditional Haggadah, Moses appears only one time. And so we see that trend trying to elevate God and minimize the human heroes, that one that starts in the Hebrew Bible, but ends later. I would say human characters are more black and white heroes in this version of the story. You find much more nuanced characterization in later versions. For me, as a humanist, I find this version of the story inspiring, meaning humans were the main actors. And God appeared, but humans were the main actors, even in the ancient stories.
I want to talk a little more about something you've hinted at a couple times, but that I think should be really explicit. You talked about midrashes. You talked about sort of later takes that come after the Bible and sort of either you could term it filling in gaps or you could term it adding on details, whatever it is. And you also mentioned in the same sentence or very near to that, that in the Bible itself, that's being done. That matters a lot from my perspective, because the second you accept that as truthful, if you do, I mean, I do, like all of a sudden the status of Torah, of Bible, of Midrash, like it's kind of an equalizing maneuver, right? It means that the original thing already is kind of fan fiction and the later stuff is also fan fiction. So like the idea that the older stuff must of necessity be elevated above the later stuff kind of, I mean, maybe it doesn't totally collapse. There's other arguments you could make for why you give that sort of precedence, but I think it becomes much more complicated. And I'm thinking about, funny enough, I've become a Star Wars guy in recent years, and I say that on purpose because it's only been in recent years. I did not grow up with a deep connection to the original three Star Wars movies. I had seen them, and they were fine, but like I wasn't that interested in them, to be totally honest. The seventh and eighth Star Wars movies for me, not the ninth, we'll get there, the seventh and eighth Star Wars movies for me were huge, and they made me connect in a way that the originals, maybe in quotes, maybe not in quotes, the originals, the original Bible, the original Star Wars, they made me connect to this story in a way that those did not.
And by the way, Lex, I know that you know this, so you're intentionally triggering me here.
Yes, yes. Dan is very much an originals Star Wars person.
Me too.
This is a generational deep religious debate. What's also true, though, is that in connecting to the seventh and eighth movies, I've gone and rewatched the originals, gained a deeper relationship to them, and understood them more. Now, I'm also leaving out the ninth movie, which I think is heinous and terrible for all sorts of reasons. And from my perspective, this goes back to what I said before, I just don't treat it as canon, as like... Sure. As if it's in the central text. I've just decided that for my Star Wars, there are eight movies, and then there's The Mandalorian, which is a TV version of it that goes in its own directions. So
I was going to ask, where do the prequels fit into this?
I mean, I don't hate the prequels to the extent that some people do, but I don't think that they're I don't spend that much time on them. But so all that's to say, we do this now. Like, this is not just some ancient rhetorical conversation about a bunch of texts that end of the day, like, so who cares? This could have major ramifications for how we understand ourselves today and what licenses we have. Going to what I said, like, I have decided there are eight Star Wars movies in my canon. I feel, like, actually allowed to make that decision because I don't think that the Star Wars movies are from God. I don't think that they are. Like, I'm clearly taking this analog too far, but like, I have the right to make my canon. So do you. You have the right to say that there are no 7, 8, and 9 if you think so. I think you're wrong. But like, that's important. Like, how could we think about this not as some ancient, trivial conversation that doesn't really matter, but actually is deeply relevant today?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I like your analogy to Star Wars a lot. And like Dan, probably generational. I like the first Star Wars. I must confess though, I probably only watched one of the sequels because I was so put off by it. I'm sorry, Lex.
That's okay. That actually strengthens the point, right?
Yeah. So, I think it's a world of choice. You know, there's not one version of the story that's right. There's not one version of the story that's in the Bible that's the right version of the story. There are multiple versions of the story in the Hebrew Bible, and there are multiple versions of that story and after in post-biblical expansions. And every one of those stories is one which you as an individual with choice can accept or reject as a story you like, you valorize, you connect to. That dynamic is applicable to all facets of our, you know, cultural artifacts we accept and what we reject. And I like it. I like the analogy to Star Wars. Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about some of the differences of opinion, let's say, within the world of biblical scholarship? Because I think a lot of us who know anything about biblical scholarship have been introduced to it via this idea called the documentary hypothesis, which is a few hundred years old, I think. The basic idea is that there were these four independent or quasi-independent sources that are each their own document. And so there would not be a way to say there was a, quote, original Bible. At the most, you might say there were two original versions, which we know of as the E source from the north and the J source from the south. And at a later point when they came together, it was kind of like to bring in pop culture references, you know, it was like the Reese's peanut butter cup commercials where your chocolate fell in my peanut butter and it turns out that it's better together. And we merge them together.
And
we have a Bible, you know, and then some people come along later and they add some other stuff to it. But you talk very differently about what we know of basically as the E source being the original Bible, the oldest one from the north. And then, so can you talk a little bit about A, why you think that versus the documentary hypothesis, and B, what does that mean? Again, like Lex's so what question, like, does it make a difference in terms of how we understand the later versions of the Bible?
I grew up with, in the beginning of my graduate school career, many years ago at Hebrew University, I grew up with two competing influences. One was my advisor, Israel Knoll, who is a proponent of the way I read text. And the other was Baruch Schwartz, who's one of the best advocates of the documentary hypothesis. But my differences of opinion really, are fairly fundamental. I do use the same names for the sources. But fundamentally, it has, like, I advocate an accretion, a paradigm of accretion. Stories build on each other. And the documentary hypothesis advocates stories being mashed together like Reese's. You know, I, for many reasons, don't buy that happened. One of them has to do with the editorial process. I don't believe it is a good, you know, the way documentary scholars conceive of mashing these texts together is an editorial process that really was occurring in the ancient world. And that's a matter for debate. I feel that I explain, you know, uncover more through this paradigm than through the documentary hypothesis. But again, I'm talking in probabilities and I'm talking in extent. I'm not talking in truth. I don't think that my way of looking at it is the truth. And I'm not particularly attached to a particular, to a hypothesis, to the documentary hypothesis or the supplementary hypothesis, which are not the only ones out there. There's a European fragmentary hypothesis as well. It's just that I'm not committed in that way. And I would say that's probably a big difference between me and documentary scholar hypothesis that I, you know, have encountered in the United States.
But can I ask you one question about how it might matter? First of all, if I'm understanding this correctly, you're saying it doesn't seem like a most likely scenario to have two independent books in front of you and then to basically be writing a third where you're taking some from this and some from this. It makes more sense to have one and then you're kind of adding to it. Yeah. That's a kind of more normal way to edit something. So that sounds makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's just like an editorial invasiveness that I don't think was a practice of ancient scribes. That, you know, might have to do with my own biases as somebody coming from a religious background. I admit that, but I do feel that's not a bad bias to have when coming to these texts, because the people writing them were also deeply religious.
From a historical standpoint, I'm just sort of curious whether you think about, like, I think about if you under the documentary hypothesis, where you imagine that both kingdoms, the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, spent some time independently creating a work of literature. And then later, perhaps when the Northern Kingdom was destroyed and the refugees came, they merged together these two pieces of literature. Then that gives you a sense that the Southern Kingdom of Judah had a more vibrant cultural life earlier on than if you were to imagine that the North came along with their already extant document into this kind of backwater. And they were the great scholars, and these northern kind of hillbilly types were there. And then they kind of, wanted to add some stuff to it to help the merger. So that kind of suggests that, it would suggest to me that the South was a less impressive cultural place until later on in history. Is that right? Is that where some of the implications lie?
The North is definitely just factually was the stronger and more dominant kingdom. You can tell this is evident in the biblical text if you look for it, because the biblical text is predominantly told from the southern perspective, and so the southern perspective is elevated. But you can just look at it factually through the archaeological remains, through population sizes in the north and in the south, towards alliances with other kingdoms in the area. The kingdom, there were times when, I would say the Northern Kingdom was like a middling kingdom, whereas in the South, they're a backwater. And you could have that perception that the South actually had more cultural, just by the extent of what the Hebrew Bible preserves. But that, there's probably plenty of stuff that the Northerners wrote that we just don't have any record of, and the Judeans just have a more coherent history to them, and that in literature, and so they preserve stuff the North didn't. I just think we just have to have a lot of humility when it comes to what we actually know. We know very, very little about the biblical about the biblical world. We can make a lot of assumptions, we can offer theories, conjectures, but what we know is not a lot, and especially about the Northern Kingdom. We know really little about the Northern Kingdom. We have so few texts from the Northern Kingdom. We have some texts in the book of, in the books of Genesis, Exodus, and Numbers. Then we have a couple Northern prophets, and we have some material about Elijah and Elisha in the book of Kings. But beyond that, we just don't have, the North, we know so little about it. And this idea that this is the way it was in the ancient world is just, I think, one that is one of hubris, meaning we don't know what happened. We don't know how these people lived. We have to have a degree of humility about it. And that, corollary of that is just giving value to the present. It's just as authentic. It's just as important and true.
So as we get close to the close, I would just love to hear a little bit more, if you'd like to share, about your personal story. And I'm curious how you came to this, or what's it like to come from a religious background to academic Bible scholarship? And then now you're a rabbi in the humanist movement. And I'm wondering if that's no accident. It's certainly for me also, as somebody who grew up religious and found biblical scholarship, I was already on my way out, as were, I think, a lot of some of the folks that we've had on this podcast, like Shulam Dean and Abby Stein, also talk about reading Who Wrote the Bible as part of their journey out of Orthodoxy. And I'm just wondering if that was true of you as well. And now that you are a humanistic rabbi, how does some of this work that you do in your academic work, how does it influence the way in which you're a humanist rabbi? And I'm also kind of curious about how maybe the kind of work, if there were many, many more humanist rabbis like you, what might humanist Judaism become to the extent that it was really plugged into a lot of these issues?
So I'm an academic brat, meaning both my parents are professors of Jewish studies. And my background is like a strong second wave feminist background. My mother was the first woman to get a PhD in rabbinics at Hebrew University. So I grew up with texts, Jewish texts as my bread and butter. But one thing my parents didn't ever do was theology. I was never told, you know, God told us to do this, so we're doing it. Usually it was, this is the way we do it in our family. And I would say I came to my doubts through the biblical text. I've been very, very attracted to the biblical text from a very, very young age. I participated in the International Bible Contest. And I was really, when I was in yeshiva, when I was matriculating from high school in Israel, I went to a Bnei Akiva yeshiva, a very right-wing Bnei Akiva yeshiva. And the way I was taught Bible there really offended me, because it was like, there are only specific answers. There are only these answers to these questions. You can't have any other answers. So the answers that were you're allowed are the ones that the Mefarshim, the commentators say, and not others. And so that offended me. And I went and deliberately went to the school in Israel where I was living, that really was known to be the place of heresy, Hebrew University, as opposed to, Bar-Ilan University or elsewhere, where you could study Bible from a more religious perspective, because I wanted to be challenged. I would say that when I came in through the gates of Hebrew University, I took to it like my mother's milk. It was really just this makes sense to me. But I came to doubt through the text. I started, I think it was after my army experience, I started doubting national narratives. It was just like, I looked at the text and I said, why am I saying this? I don't believe it. Like I don't accept this. This is offensive to my values. I don't buy into it. And that attitude of doubt, I would say, propelled me to ultimately to rewrite liturgy for myself. That it's a very personal project. I've been doing it for 17 years. And ultimately I came to the humanist rabbinate through rewriting liturgy. That's been my big project, still is, it's still constant. I'm rewriting Mao's Tzur, which is the most classical of the songs for Hanukkah.
Good, bad, because I read the lyrics recently and I was like, I don't think I really want to be singing this.
So, yeah. And, I'm married to somebody who's a Rosh Hashiva at Hadar. So it comes from a very different angle than I do. And so I sing Mao's Tzur every night. And I'm like, my knowledge of Hebrew is sufficient to know that I completely don't buy into that. And so finally, I've been thinking about, I've had several aborted attempts, but finally I'm on my fourth verse. I'm rewriting Mao's Tzur. Rewriting, telling a new story is like that connect, that's that thread connects what I do with liturgy and with Bible. I like to tell a story that means something to me and is authentic to the way things were or the way I am.
I love the personal narrative that you're bringing in. And I think maybe as a last question, this can sort of extend that. You've talked a little bit about your rabbiing, and you've talked a lot of it about your academic work and your approach to Bible. I spend a lot of time wrestling with that duality. Like, I wish that it wasn't so much of a duality. I actually would like, in both directions, for those people to be learning more from each other and interacting more with each other. I would like people in those scholarly debates about documentary, supplementary, fragmentary, thin mint, surrey. Like, I would like them to learn more and interact more with, I don't know, the on the ground, quote unquote, people in Jewish communities. Not because I think they need to like change their scholarship to meet them, but because I think it would be, it would build some really beautiful work. And the other direction, I would like people in Jewish life, the rabbis, the cantors, the Jewish educators, the Jews in the pews, the everyone, to be interacting in a more sophisticated, deep way with Bible. And I think part of that is, of necessity, interacting with biblical scholarship. Yeah. So I'd love to hear from you from your own personal lens, where you're like straddling in the 1 foot here, 1 foot there sense, these two realms. How might we approach them moving forward? How could we either break down this duality or look at it in a new way?
So yeah, you're right. I live in that duality on a daily basis. I mean, I constantly, this is like part of the process of writing this book was try to like, you know, it was a deeply personal process of trying to get rid of the jargony language that I used as an academic, all those terms that people don't know, they see and then their mind freezes up. And so I tried to avoid that a lot in this book. You know, I would like to break that down. I'm not an academic at this point, you know, in my soul, because I don't buy the ivory tower approach to knowledge. I want what I learn to be meaningful to others. I want what I, you know, the knowledge that I've spent so many years accruing painfully to have some relevance to the greater society, which is part of a big reason why I'm a rabbi, meaning I want my knowledge to have use in the world. And I would say that we, you know, breaking that down would be good. You know, academics finding more, you know, being more public intellectuals and rabbis, you know, really need to up their game a little in understanding the biblical text. My first gig as a professor was at a rabbinical school, you know, and it was really, you know, it's very important for me that rabbis, are knowledgeable about these ways of approaching the text. And I would say, and then the twain shall meet, meaning, and then you'll have much more productive conversations.
Productive conversations is going to be the last phrase of this productive conversation. Thank you so much, Tzemach Yireh, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
My pleasure, Lex. My pleasure, Dan. This was absolutely fantastic. I enjoyed myself greatly.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future, especially to some of our remaining episodes in this unit of episodes looking at Torah, looking at Bible. It has been so fun so far. It's going to keep being fun. And if you want to be in touch with us, if you want to send us notes, questions, thoughts, whatever you have, please, please do. We really appreciate it. And you can do so via any of the following avenues. First, there's our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. There's also Twitter and Instagram. All of those are just at Judaism Unbound for our handles. There is our website, judaismunbound.com. And there are our email addresses, dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you're able to set aside and send our way, which you can do via judaismunbound.com/donate on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.